100 years ago, an entire Iowa family was wiped out by an axe-wielding killer in the town of Villisca. The crime was never solved.
We were sure they were going to find somebody hiding someplace.
This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, we re-examine Iowa's worst mass homicide, committed in June of 1912. My guests are filmmakers Tammy and Kelly Rundle. They created an award-winning documentary about the killing and its aftermath. The investigation yielded several suspects, one of which was tried twice and acquitted. We'll also be joined by historian Edgar Epperly. The mystery surrounding the Villisca axe murders, after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this hour we look back at Iowa's worst mass homicide, the investigation that followed it, and the questions that remain unanswered in this still unsolved crime. On June 10th, 1912, an entire Iowa family was wiped out by an axe-wielding killer in the town of Villisca in the southwestern part of the state. In 2004, Iowa filmmakers Tammy and Kelly Rundle of Fourth Wall Films released an award-winning documentary film about the axe murders called Villisca, Living with a Mystery. Let's start off by listening to a couple of excerpts from the documentary film. First of all, a woman who has since passed away, Irvaline Curtis Brown, 12 years old at the time of the murders, followed by Bruce Stillions, a historian.
One of the things I remember so well was that the police came through the alleys and they went up into the hay bale of our barn. We were sure they were going to find somebody hiding someplace. And that's just as shivery now as it was then.
There was the beginning of a mythology immediately afterwards. And part of the mythology was sort of an exaggeration. This was, according to one newspaper, the most horrible event that had occurred in the history of the United States. Well, and then that goes on. It goes on to now there was the worst terror there. However, I have the feeling that people were pretty afraid. And they didn't know where this came from, and more than that, they couldn't explain the evil that it suggested.
Passion River Films is releasing a commemorative edition of this documentary film, a couple of excerpts there from it, Villisca, Living with a Mystery on DVD, this coming October with new bonus features. Joining us for the hour to re-examine this unsolved crime, filmmakers Tammy and Kelly Rundle of Fourth Wall Films. Welcome to our studio.
Thanks for having us.
Also joining us, featured in the film, historian Edgar Epperly. He is retired from the Department of professor of the Department of Education at Luther College. He's researched and studied this case since 1955, and was even allowed access to the DCI's file on the case. Ed Epperly, welcome to you.
Glad to be here.
Well, a warning going out to our listeners for this hour that our discussion will necessarily include some graphic details of the crime scene that some listeners may find disturbing. If you need to turn off the radio to avoid that, now would be a good time. Let's start off by having you set the scene for us. Villisca, Iowa, 1912, June. Tell us the story of how this murder was discovered. Ed?
Yeah. Hank Horton, who is the marshal, he came out of the city hall a little after 8 o'clock. It was a cool morning, cloudy. It looked like it was going to rain. And he saw a fellow coming across the courthouse square. I got to correct that. It was a square, but they don't have a courthouse. That's in Red Oak. This was Ed Selle, who was a clerk at Joe Moore's hardware store. And he said, get down to Joe Moore's place. There's trouble there. And so the two of them went three blocks east and one block north, and got to the house of Joe Moore. Joe Moore was a 43-year-old merchant in town. He had a hardware store. The town itself, 2,500 people, main line of the railroad, still is on the Amtrak line. It goes through Iowa. It's a trading center. It was a prosperous little town in 1912. And there on the door was Ross Moore, who was a druggist in town, and he was a brother to Joe Moore. And he had a key, gave it to Hank Horton, and Hank let himself in the west door on the porch. And as he described it, it was dark as night in that house. Every shade was drawn clear to the sill. Someone had taken skirt and covered the glass in the front door so that light couldn't get out of the front door even. He walked across the front parlor, pushed open the door, and there were two figures lying in bed. They were completely covered with bedclothes, but he could see blood on the bedstead. He went across that room and opened the blind on the north window and pulled back the covers. Their faces were covered with nightshirt kind of thing, and they were had been hit in the head with an axe. Both of them were dead, of course. The axe was leaning on the south wall, and beside it was a four-pound piece of slab bacon. There was a light at the foot of the bed, but it was a lamp, but it was unlit, and the chimney of that lamp was under the dresser on the east wall. The dresser had a lyre-back dresser, and it had a black skirt draped over it so that the mirror had been covered. He went upstairs. Ed Selly, the hardware clerk who had followed him in, had seen enough, and he went out on the front porch. And he went up the stairs. It's an S-curve, very narrow stairway with clothes on pegs hanging up the side. He entered a room. There's no hall there. You go directly into the room from the stairway. And here's a bed running east and west, and Joe and Sarah Moore, the parents, were covered the same way, and they had been struck with an axe several times. He went into the south bedroom, and there were four children lying in bed, each of them covered, pulled back the covers, and they had all been killed with the axe, too. So there were a total of eight victims, six Moores, the four children and the parents, and then two girls downstairs who he couldn't recognize. So he went out on the front porch, and there Ross was, and he said, "My God, Ross, there's somebody murdered in every bed." And that was the discovery of the murder.
It turned out that these two young girls were having a sleepover at the house. This was Ina and Lena Stillinger spending the night at the Moore's house, unfortunately, on that night. Eight dead in June of 1912. Pick up the story with the aftermath. A small town in Iowa, a town anywhere, this sort of horrendous crime would set off a panic. It did indeed, as you describe in your film. Tell us about that, Kelly.
I think we look at the story now and we see echoes of that story today when there's a tragedy, and in the wake of that tragedy, what people do and how people feel. But as Bruce described in that clip that we listened to, Martians could have landed in the square in Villisca, and it would have been strange on the same level. And we have to think about a time when the ability for law enforcement to coordinate a successful investigation of what was not a conventional murder. It was a kind of a psychological murder. And so what to do and how to solve it, just unknown. We think of other crimes that have occurred that are more conventional and get resolved quickly. And we had people with a desire in Villisca to solve it, because literally people were wondering, well, what do we do now? You know, do we bolt the doors? We toured a house in Villisca where they had installed bolts on the insides of doors, bedroom doors, so that they would, someone coming in at night would have much greater trouble getting to them.
And you point committing. Out in your film that people in their yards had strings attached to empty cans as sort of an early warning system for anyone entering their yard. People were really panicked. Tammy?
Well, one of the things that I found very interesting about the case, after the murders were discovered, were a large number of people that spilled out of their homes, were congregated around this house, and were able to slip in and look at the crime scene, compromise the crime scene, and actually went in and were looking at these tragic victims.
Right. The bodies were there until late in the evening after being discovered in the morning in place in their bed. So you had, what do we guess, tens or hundreds of people who traipsed through the house, no doubt disturbing significant evidence.
Mm-hmm. I've heard at least dozens. The suspicion was it was probably closer to 100 or more. And the county coroner was working. He'd gotten there about 9:30, quarter to 10. And he was looking at the bodies and people. He said it was a madhouse in there. People were running from room to room and shouting. And he said to a guy named Overman, who was the night marshal in Villisca at the time, a young man, 26, I think. And he said, why don't you get these people out of here? And he said, I can't do it. I push them in out the front door and they come in the back. So it was 11 o'clock or later before they got the scene controlled.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned before we went on air that actually somebody removed evidence from the crime scene. Not only evidence, but significant evidence.
That's right. Macabre touch. A local pool hall operator, Bert McCall, managed to pick up a piece of Joe Moore's skull, a bone, not quite as large as a cigarette pack, but a fairly substantial piece of bone. And he showed it around his pool hall the week after the murder. A year later, after he had sold the pool hall, the new owner found it in a cigar box, took it home, showed his wife, and she said, I don't want that horrid thing around here. And so he came back at noon, and he said, I chucked it in the gutter on 3rd Avenue.
Let's talk a little bit about what followed. The National Guard, Iowa National Guard, was called in to restore order as the panic in the townspeople came about. Let's talk a little bit about the manhunt that ensued. We have another cut from your film, Villisca, Living with a Mystery. This is, again, Ervaline Curtis Brown, 12 years old at the time of the crime, the axe murder. And this is her description of bloodhounds being brought into town.
One of the things all day was, we were waiting for the bloodhounds to come by rail on a certain number 9 or something. We knew exactly what time. And, oh, it seems to me our thought was so much, don't let it rain. That'll spoil the scent for the bloodhounds.
Okay, what was the action taken then? This involved 1,000 people hunting for, who did they think committed this crime?
Yeah, the bloodhound run was a kind of a spectacle at the time, and the crowd perhaps was 1,000 people, maybe 1,500 people on foot, on horseback, and in automobiles following this these dogs. And I think a lot of people were pinning their hopes on the dogs, thinking that that would lead to a quick resolution. The dogs did follow the same trail 3 times from the house to the river, but leading to nothing in particular. So
they had a scent. They were following a scent, though.
They appeared to be. And one of the things we did with the film is we talked to bloodhound experts so we could kind of understand, well, what did this mean? We had a good description of the bloodhound run. And I think perhaps they did follow the trail that the killer might have used to exit the city of Villisca. But nonetheless, it didn't lead to a resolution. And Ervaline tells a story about being up late that first night, and she was supposed to have gone to bed with her sister, but they were kind of waiting around the stairs up above. And one of the coroner's jurors, a man named Finlayson, a family friend, stopped by after viewing the bodies with the coroner and then described the scene. And they were kind of listening in as this was told to their parents that night.
We had Ed describe the crime scene there. Ritualistic was a word, I think, in the film that is used again and again. Talk a little bit about what the evidence on the crime scene initially indicated, what the thoughts of the town people were about who did this, who they were after. They thought they were after a maniac, someone from outside the town. Is that fair?
That's correct. The officials thought that there had been other murders in the year before that were very similar in Colorado, Illinois, and Kansas. And so the initial thought was it was a continuation of that. And if it wasn't that, then it was a deranged person who and they thought of it as a sexual murder because the young girl downstairs, Lena Stillinger, was displayed in the bed, and they thought the killer was looking at her. They were acquainted with mental illness. They're only about 15 miles from Clarendo, which was is a large mental hospital at that time, one of Iowa's four mental hospitals. And so people worked there, people knew about insanity, and they assumed the killer was somehow deranged. They did not initially think it would have been done for any motive, but conventional motive like money or even anger or resentment, things like that.
The murder weapon, the axe, was found in the house. No attempt to hide that. What do we know about the axe? Who did that belong to?
According to, I think it was the coroner's inquest, Joe Moore's brother, perhaps it was Harry, testified that it was, in fact, his brother's axe that perhaps had been sold at his hardware store, and it was damaged or defective. It had a chip on the blade and perhaps had been returned. And Joe was using it at home there to break up coal. So the killer would have found the axe in the coal shed behind the Moore's house. And that kind of leads to how crime scenes are now classified. They're classified now as being either organized, disorganized, or mixed. And the Villisca crime scene shows signs of being a mixed crime scene. Organized would mean that a killer would, for example, bring a murder weapon with them and would try to leave very little evidence behind. The Villisca case, of course, the murder weapon was a weapon of opportunity. That's a disorganized element. The ritualistic nature of the crime scene, of tidying up the crime scene and hiding the victims, that's a sign of an organized crime. So you have in the Villisca case what would now be called a mixed crime scene.
Mm-hmm. What about the covering of the windows? What does that indicate? What did that indicate at the time?
I don't know that people knew. I think people felt that the killer obviously spent a good deal of time in the house. It wasn't a case of striking them and running out the front door or anything like that. It looked like he tried to make sure that he would have light that would not show out of the house so that person walking by in the middle of the night would not wonder what's wrong at the Moors and maybe even come over and offer to help kind of thing. He had, for some reason, the need for time to be in the house. It looks like he struck the parents twice with a separation in between because there was a shoe at the edge of the bed. The blood ran across the pillow and filled that shoe. But when the authorities found it, the shoe had been turned over and there was blood dripping on the sole, or had dripped on the sole. And by the time they got there, the blood had all congealed, so that meant that had to happen during the night when the killer was there, and suggested that the killer struck them, the shoe filled with blood, the killer came back, turned it over by mistake probably, inadvertently, and then they were just completely mutilated above the shoulders, and so he apparently had a need to take out his violent feelings towards them.
Tammy Rundle.
What's been interesting, too, is when you go back and look at the records, you can really see where a lot of evidence is left behind. There was a watch that was left in the guest room, and we wondered, why would Joe Moore's watch be down there? But perhaps the killer was keeping track of time in case he's wanting to catch a train to get out of town. So that's something that was kind of interest as well. Something else, a lot of people go through the crime scene. They're starting to move things around. The piano gets pulled out. You know, the axe is moving around the house. So it's hard to determine what is going on. Was there somebody hiding behind the piano? Was there somebody in the closet? You know, rumors are starting to form, and it is really confusing, and those still exist today.
As you point out in your film, the science of fingerprinting was in its infancy. Didn't do much good in this case, did it?
No, didn't help that the fingerprint expert arrived four sheets to the wind, drunk and falling down drunk. But in those days, there's no central repository. They're actually trying to take photographs of fingerprints, and not much success there. The investigator was from Leavenworth Penitentiary, and he did a good job, as Ed has noted, of documenting blood spatters and other things in a way that's similar to what they do now.
Mm-hmm. One of the more bizarre aspects of this case noted that lots of so many fascinating details here, but there, I think this was only a rumor, correct me if I'm wrong, that Mrs. Moore's eyes, or perhaps it was rumored her entire head, was transported to Iowa City for examination. Why?
Well, Ed, do you want to tell where that story kind of comes from?
Sure. That rumor was widely spread across southwest Iowa, appeared in newspapers, things like that. And it was based on the idea that if the eye saw someone, the last thing they saw, it would be preserved on the retina of the eye. And so they took the eye to photograph it and get a picture of the killer. Or some people said, no, they sent the whole head. But in either case, that actually came from a novel that was very popular, so popular that I've forgotten the name of it.
The Klansman.
The Klansman, thank you, which became the basis for the movie?
Birth of a Nation.
Thank you again. That novel uses that plot line to catch the killer. And so everyone, that was in 1907, it was a bestseller. So I suspect many, many people had read that. And I'm quite sure that's the or not just an opinion on my part, but I think that's the origin of that idea.
We're talking about Iowa's worst mass homicide 100 years ago, June of 1912, an entire Iowa family, the Moore family, wiped out by an axe-wielding killer. The town of Villisca remains unsolved. We are going to take a break in a minute or two, but give us a preview of what's to come, because when we come back, we want to talk about the investigation, also the many suspects came to light in the course of the investigation, the trials, the ordeal that lasted several years. A preview of that?
I just saw the Des Moines Register from 1917 covering the trial, and they described the condition in Montgomery County, compared it to a Tennessee Mountain feud situation. So we have a situation where people took up sides for or against a local suspect, and chaos ensued.
Okay, we'll talk about, when we come back, talk about George Kelly, the Reverend George Kelly, also termed the Little Minister. He was a man of smaller stature, tried twice for this murder, acquitted for it, also a suspect. Frank F. Jones, Villisca resident, also an Iowa state senator. William Mansfield, Blackie Mansfield, as he was called. Theory that the senator hired William Blackie Mansfield. Also a man named Henry Lee Moore, ex-husband of John's sister. We'll learn about how they fit into this fascinating investigation. Suspects in Iowa's worst mass homicide remains still unsolved today. And we'll talk about the many fascinating aspects when we come back. And we have with us today filmmakers Tammy and Kelly Rundle of Fourth Wall Films, also historian and writer Edgar Epperly, who is featured in this film. That's when we come back. More on the Villisca Axe Murders of 1912. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And this hour, looking back at Iowa's worst mass homicide and the investigation that followed, the questions that remain unanswered in this still unsolved crime. On June 10th, 1912, an entire Iowa family wiped out by an axe-wielding killer in the town of Villisca. Also, two visitors made that number of murdered eight people killed. In 2004, Iowa filmmakers Tammy and Kelly Rundle of Fourth Wall Films released an award-winning documentary film about the axe murders called Villisca, Living with a Mystery. They join us this hour, along with a historian, writer, Edgar Epperly, featured in the film, who has intimate knowledge, has been studying this case literally for decades in our studio this hour. Let's pick up with the investigation, pick up the story from here, and let's move on to who was first suspected of this heinous crime? Ed?
The day of the murder, there were many people suspecting a local man, F.F. Jones, Frank Jones, who was a hardware and implement dealer in town, a banker, a leader in the Methodist Church, a state senator. He had been a state representative for 3 terms and just would be elected that fall in the state Senate. They suspected him because they didn't have another suspect, and he was the person who had a conventional motive for something like this. Today, it doesn't seem like the motives were sufficient, but in that day, they felt that he was the only person that might be behind it. They had the business competition that I talked about because Joe Moore also had a hardware implement dealership. In fact, Joe had been an employee of F.F. Jones until 1907 when he opened a competing firm, and he took the John Deere Plow Company franchise with him. So they were bitter enemies, business enemies. In the words of a lawyer in Red Oak I talked to once, he said, F.F. Jones was an arrogant son of a bitch. And that's just the tone he put to it. The people thought of him as arrogant, looked down his nose at them, things like that. But the real reason was his daughter-in-law was having an affair with the murdered man. And everyone in town knew that because they made their meetings at her house when her husband wasn't home over the telephone. And in those days, that was common knowledge because the Central girls would listen in and they would repeat that to their friends. And so everyone in town was aware of that.
And the idea here was that F.F. Jones himself, but he hired a man named Blackie Mansfield to murder the Moore family. Who's Blackie Mansfield?
That came a bit later because the locals did not have any idea how he did it. No one suspected him of physically swinging the axe, but they thought he would have hired it done, but they didn't know who he would hire. A detective came to town, James N. Wilkerson. He got there in 1914, and in the summer of 1914, he announced that F.F. Jones was behind the murder. And 2 years later, in 1916, he arrested a man named William Mansfield, who he called Blackie, although no one else had ever called him Blackie, and his hair was kind of a sandy blonde.
He was not African-American.
No. He picked that name, I think, because he thought it sounded like a underworld nickname, and it just added to his case, he thought. So he was arrested, but he was released. They had a grand jury that investigated him, and he was released because he had evidence, he had documentary, he had pay slips, and he had testimony from people that he was working in Montgomery, Illinois, 400 miles from Villisca, when the murder happened.
Is it true, though, isn't it so, in as you document in the film, Kelly and Tammy, that he was held over a bridge by his heels to confess, which he did?
Yeah, they did things a little different in those days. and he didn't confess. He never confessed. And it's because he didn't commit the crime. But I think the name Blackie actually comes from Wilkerson's working with a man named Jack Boyle in Kansas City, who was working for the Post. And Boyle later penned the Boston Blackie series of novels and movies. So I think that's where the name came from. And they just sort of gave it to him because it was colorful.
Okay. Well, the other connection with why William Mansfield was so attractive to Wilkerson was because his wife, daughter, and other family members were murdered with an axe in, was that 1914?
It was 1914 in Blue Island, Illinois.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So his alibi checks out. Pay stubs, other things, proof that he is not there. We have another suspect to tell us about George Kelly, the Reverend George Kelly, otherwise known as the Little Minister. How did he become a suspect?
Kelly was an immigrant from England. He was a tiny man, 5'2", and weighed 119 pounds when he was arrested. he was suspected early on, and he drew attention to himself by writing letters to all the officials. I mean, county sheriff, the county attorney, the state attorney general, the town marshal, in which he talked about the murder, and he seemed both obsessed by it, and he had a great deal of information. He talked about the killer was interrupted by people walking by and things like that. And they wondered how he knew that. So they did an investigation in 1912, but they recognized he was very eccentric, perhaps mentally ill. He was obsessed by the murder. They wondered if maybe he was deluded, and so they did not arrest him. He got in trouble in 1914 for running an ad in the Omaha World Herald, requiring for advertising for a secretary. Got a woman responded. He said, "You sound great. You'll be just fine, but you do have to type in nude." And she thought that a strange work condition and gave it to her minister. It got to the postal authorities, and he was arrested for sending obscene material through the mail.
Also a bit of evidence against him, a bloody shirt discovered that he wanted cleaned.
There was a bloody shirt that he took to a laundry in Council Bluffs a week after the murder.
Pretty incriminating, isn't it?
Well, a lot of people, he talked about he cut himself shaving, which was a common straight razor days, and that's a common injury. They had lots of bloody shirts in Council Bluffs, so they didn't put a great deal of credence to it. But it was an incriminating thing to do. Mm-hmm.
Before our hour gets away from us, let's talk about another suspect there. George Kelly, the story with him, how was he not brought to trial?
Or he was.
He was the one brought to trial. So tell us the end of that story.
Well, he was finally arrested. The grand jury indicted him in 1917. By this time, Wilkerson was fighting to protect him, claiming he was being framed by Jones. And they had a trial in the fall of 1917. And the evidence against him was his confession. He claimed that he couldn't sleep that night. He was walking down the road. He saw these two children going to bed. And just then the Lord's voice came to him and said, "Suffer the little children to come unto me." And I raised my hands and said, "Yea, Lord, thy servant heareth," and went in the house and killed everybody. He also had the bloody shirt that you talked about and the a long history of window peeking and obsession with nudity and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so they tried him, but he was acquitted.
On what grounds?
Well, they didn't believe he was guilty. They thought he was being framed. They thought that F.F. Jones was using his political and financial influence to protect him. So it was 11-1 for acquittal and 1 for acquittal by reason of insanity. Hung jury. They retried him in November and let him go free. Tried completely.
Talking with Ed Epperly, featured in the film that we're talking about also today, Living with a Mystery, Villisca, Living with a Mystery, recounting Iowa's worst mass homicide and the investigation that followed. The answers that still remain in this unanswered, unsolved crime, I should say. One other name, a suspect, Henry Lee Moore, no relation to the family. Who was he?
Henry Lee Moore was someone that we originally saw in the archives in Des Moines, saw a reference to him. And something we did for the film was we took the crime scene information and had it examined by forensic experts without any additional information about suspects or even the context beyond the records. And the profile that was created by Robert K. Ressler, a former FBI agent and a profiler, we realized fit this Henry Lee Moore even almost to his exact age. So Henry Lee Moore was discovered in the sense because he had murdered in December of 1912. He murdered his mother and grandmother and was arrested for that crime. As we began to look at his movements, we realized that he was sort of unavailable before the series of murders began. He was incarcerated. Then he became available. The murders begin to occur, and the series seems to end with the murders in Columbia, Missouri. So while we don't say in the film that he was the killer, he at least represents the type of individual that our forensic people pointed toward.
So is there a consensus among you three, Kelly, Tammy, and Ed, people who have studied this case for years, what we will call an unsolved crime. Is there a consensus? Do you agree on who probably committed this act?
I think we agree on who did not commit the act. We do not believe that F.F. Jones hired anybody to kill Joe Moore. Kelly and I tend to think that it was probably a serial killer. And Ed?
A serial killer, meaning this Henry Lee Moore.
Possibly Henry Lee Moore.
I tend to feel that Kelly was probably guilty. What I have spent a lot of time doing and not being effective at was to find out if Kelly himself could have been in any of these other towns where the murders occurred when those murders occurred. He was a preacher. He traveled a lot. And he had a Chautauqua presentation that he claimed he had given 300 times. I expect there's some hyperbole there, but still, he gave it many times. And I've tried to find out whether he had a list of places where he spoke and things like that, but I haven't been able to do that. So I generally say I'm about 60% convinced that Kelly was guilty and about 40% convinced it was a serial killer.
George Kelly, the Reverend Kelly, a very small man, though. How could he wield an axe against eight people?
I'm always asked that question. we laugh. This is Iowa. I mean, we've got all kinds of 119-pound wrestlers who throw each other around the mat. You've seen TV. You've been to these meets. And, of course, he could do that.
Okay.
That's a big axe, and he swings that sucker, it's going to do damage.
Now, Ben, the forensic people back you up on this.
Oh, they do. They had the same question.
Part of the profile that we got was a man of a more substantial nature than our redheaded Mr. Kelly.
Yes, yes.
Let's talk about more contemporary issues having to do with the Villisca axe murder. Stephen Bowman is a writer who reawakened the controversy over this murder with a book that he brought out, a novel, in fact, called Morning Ran Red in the 1980s. How does this fit into the story, Kelly?
Well, in our film, what we wanted to look at, I sometimes say the film we made isn't about the murders. It's really about everything that happened as a result of the crime. And we look at the way that story evolved in the decades that followed the crime in the city of Villisca. Well, one of the things that happened was that the story kind of went dormant for a while. And during a 14-year period, Stephen was writing this novel. The novel is based on the F.F. Jones theory, and when it came out in 1986, people were sort of surprised by it, and they were deeply offended by it in a number of ways. It was a very sensational version of the story. It was a kind of a folklore version of the story. And the community, it was the catalyst, I guess, for the community deciding they wanted to try to control how the story was going to be used. So in 1987, a year later, you had their first Heritage Days, which was the first time the community publicly acknowledged the axe murders as a part of their history.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about Villisca today. How does the town deal with its legacy? You said they, in the 80s, when this book came out, they tried to take back control of the story.
I think that changed, and they don't have control of the story anymore. And I think that probably frustrates people a little bit.
What is most hotly debated in the town of Villisca now?
Well, I don't know. They would probably disagree about what it was. I think there's some aspects of the house is a tourist attraction now. And people have strong feelings about that one way or another.
People can go pay admittance and tour it.
Correct.
What will they see? You've toured it?
The house has been restored to its 1912 appearance. And so when you take the tour, you really are looking at a home that probably looks, you know, very much like it did the day the murders were discovered. And it reveals something about the crime to you. If you've just read about it in books, seeing the way this town is laid out, you know, at the end of the street where the house is, or the two churches, the split in the community was essentially between those two denominations, the Presbyterians and the Methodists. The Presbyterians took the side of the Moors against the Joneses, and the Joneses were Methodists, and so they took that side. So the geography is important. And then when you're in the house, when we went through with Bob Moore Jr., who was a nephew of the murdered man, he marveled at how tiny it was and how great a risk the killer was taking to himself by entering a home with so many people in it.
How are you received in Villisca these days as filmmakers who have also tried to report in this in a journalistic way?
Very well, I think. I think we communicated a lot with people in town during the 10 years we were making the film. It helped that we were affiliated or associated with Ed Epperle, who already had a relationship with people in town, but they were skeptical at first. We were based in Los Angeles at that time, and we gradually gained their confidence. And then I think when the film was done, our sense was that they accepted it as a historical and a fair telling of the tale. We didn't pull any punches, but this is a story that requires no embellishment whatsoever.
What were the greatest challenges in making this film, retelling this story? It's a complicated
story. It's extremely complicated. And when we first started on the film, we decided we were going to shoot it on 16mm film, which is expensive. So when I think about what the challenge was, it was, of course, raising the money to get the film done. The other thing was finding photographs. We're not dealing with motion pictures or anything like that. We were needing stills of what was taking, to help us visualize the story. And having Ed Epperle as our primary consultant really is what helped us to keep the story accurate and to make a complex story appealing or people able to make sense of it.
You have several people recalling who were young people at the time of the murder. Was it a challenge to get them to talk to about this after the sort of the aura of this terrible murder around Villisca? Was there a hesitancy there?
Yeah, we had some initial publicity or an announcement about the project in the fall of 1993, and the interviews with the older women in the film came as a result of that. And in fact, we flew back immediately to do those interviews because they were elderly. Irvaline, who we mentioned, and you have the quotes from her, we listened to earlier, she left town, her family left town sort of disgusted by the community split and discouraged with it, and she never wanted people to ask where she was from her whole life. And it really wasn't until after we did the interview from the film that she began sort of talking to her friends about it, and sort of somehow that opened her up to talking about it where she'd spent almost 100 years of her life not wanting to talk about it.
One of the benefits of starting when we did in 2004 was that we were able to talk, or I'm sorry, 1994, was there were a number of these older people who were alive at the time who were able to talk to us on film.
Ed Epperle, you are featured in the film, prominently in this film. We have just a couple minutes left, but for you, this has been a major part of your life's work, exploring this case. What are the most fascinating aspects of the case throughout the decades? What have they been for you? What fascinates you the most?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the complexity of the event, as you talk about, the fact there are really three stories, one, F.F. Jones, Kelly, and the serial killer theory. So that's been fun to explore. The other thing is the way the community was so divided. We have so many conspiracy theories now, and it's interesting to see how one develops from the inside. If you look at the detective, he came in and hoodwinked the whole town, really.
Wilkerson.
Wilkerson, the detective, and convinced them that Jones was guilty and did a very pernicious thing. There was a lot of damage done to that community. And to trace that and to try to bring the story, even if we don't discover, and I don't think we will, who actually committed the murder, we ought to help the community, we ought to help society get some kind of a feeling for a conspiracy like that.
Aside from the answer to the question of who actually committed this murder, what question would answer that question? If you could pick one answer to get, what question would you ask, Ed?
Well, if you could, we could either convict or eliminate Kelly as a suspect by finding out that he was in one of the communities where another murder occurred when that murder occurred. The coincidence would be so great that this disturbed little man could be in two murder scenes and not be involved. That would satisfy me. Or we could find out that he was not in those communities. We find that he was somewhere else for certain. Then we know he's not the killer.
Final critical questions from either you, Tammy, or Kelly about this case that you would like to find out?
I think you could do something similar with Henry Lee Moore. You could disprove that theory in terms of his involvement by just, you know, documenting his appearance in the wrong place, you know, during a crime, or the right place during a crime.
Okay, fascinating. Fascinating hour of discussion with Kelly Rundle and Tammy Rundle of Fourth Wall Films. They produced this film called Villisca, Living with a Mystery, and a commemorative edition of Villisca, Living with a Mystery on DVD will be out in October with new bonus features. Ed Epperly featured in the film, historian. Thank you very much for joining us, all of you. It's been fascinating as we explore this heinous crime. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, Jeff Schmidt. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.